After the end of World War II, most countries in Eastern Europe went from being ruled by German Nazis to being dominated by Soviet Russia. It would take decades for democratic freedoms to be realized. Less than a decade into its communist era, a group of university students in Hungary presented their demands for political and economic reforms to the national radio station. The authorities replied by shooting them dead. It was October of 1956, and college student Michael Korda wanted to see for himself how the student-led revolts were spreading through the population. He joins us in this special interview for Travel with Rick Steves to describe what he experienced. Michael, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, your part is so romantic to me. Age 24, you're an Oxford student in England. Yes, the son of a Hungarian emigre, but you had never been to Hungary.
And no, never.
You had a chance to dive in there like the romantics who went to the Spanish Civil War in the cause of freedom. So in 56, you and three friends from Oxford hopped in a beat-up old V-dub and drove to Budapest with medicine for hospitals.
That is true.
What was that like?
It was strange. I must say that all four of us had done our national service, 2.5 years of the British Armed Services, and supposed that we would have lots of useful advice to give the Hungarian students about fighting. That turned out not to be really the case. They had already learned much more about blowing up tanks than we knew. Mm-hmm. But the site of the hospital in Budapest, where we went with our load of medications and anesthetics and antiseptics, was extraordinary and reminiscent perhaps of the Ukraine today. People lying in the corridor of the hospital, The hospital being shelled by Russian tanks. Mm-hmm. It was so exciting that one did not really feel fear. You only felt fear later on when you looked back at it and said, why on earth did I do that and what was I thinking of?
Well, there was a drama. I mean, when I look at those Hungarian flags that had that Soviet emblem in the middle of them,
right.
And then I see those flags that were, the emblem was literally cut out. So you've got like a donut flag, right? It's got that hole.
Right.
What does that hole mean to you when you look at it as a combatant in this revolution?
It means a determination to rid themselves, not just of the Russians, but of the Russian-sponsored and supported Hungarian government, which was, it was more Stalinist than Stalin.
Oh my goodness, that's a big statement. Severe
torture, terrible trials over what seemed to us small matters of communist doctrine, all of it ending, of course, in executions. It was a horrendous government, and it impelled the Hungarians to rise up and fight. One reason, by the way, that they were able to is that the Hungarian communist government had always supposed that if a revolution came, it would be coming from the right. And therefore, they filled the factories with arsenals so that if that ever happened, the workers would have access to weapons and ammunition in order to defend themselves and the state. But that enabled the workers to break the arsenals open where they worked and arm themselves against the state, so that within the first few days of the revolution, hundreds of thousands of people armed themselves and fought the Russians.
Michael, you were there. You were there, mm-hmm. And the way I understand it, there was a short period of freedom, and it was a world of Molotov cocktails. It was a world of students taking over radio stations. It was a period where Hungarians were like tasting freedom. Tell us a little bit about that whole student-led revolution and the Molotov cocktails being tossed at big indestructible tanks and the importance of taking a radio station.
Well, we saw plenty of that. I mean, the students were incredible. Now, I have to say that the most incredible thing is that the students and the factory workers and, to some extent, the Hungarian army soldiers all fought side by side, so there were no class differences or education differences in their way. It was a very impressive demonstration of national feeling that was beyond any question of class, profession, or education. And yes, I mean, one saw 18-year-old students run up to Russian tanks you have to get within 5 or 6 feet of them and throw a Molotov cocktail onto the back of the tank where the engine exhaust and ventilation is. And if you did that successfully, the tank would catch fire and in an instant blow up. Blow up so that it comes completely to pieces and the gun and the turret, you know, end up 100 feet from the tank. Amazing to see it. Amazing that people would do it. But they did.
Yeah. I understand that the Hungarians even turned the street signs around so that when the tanks came in, the Soviet tanks, they didn't know where to go.
That's also true. But by and large, the first stage of the revolution, the first week of the revolution, the Hungarians fought the Russians to a draw, and the Russians evacuated their forces from Budapest, the capital of Hungary, because they were relying on the Russian troops that were present in Hungary, who were mostly national service conscripts. There was then several days during which the Russians pretended to negotiate with the provisional Hungarian government, while in fact they brought up strong professional troops and more modern tanks from the Ukraine and from deep inside Russia, and then attacked and put the revolution down. So the revolution divides itself up into three relatively short periods. It was thrilling and exciting to see a country throwing off its occupiers and getting rid of its government and installing a new one. It was very difficult the last week of the revolution to see how that was put down with such brutality and bloodshed.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're getting an intimate and personal look at the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 today with Michael Korda. Michael is a writer and novelist with more than 20 titles to his name. Born in the United Kingdom to English and Hungarian parents, he served in the Royal Air Force. His role in the Hungarian Revolution earned him the Order of Merit of the Republic of Hungary. We have links to Michael's work in the show notes for this episode at ricksteves.com/radio. Michael's book is Journey to a Revolution, a personal memoir and history of Hungarian Revolution in 1956. Michael, Hungary, to me, always was sort of the odd duck in the Warsaw Pact. It always had a little more feistiness, a little more freedom, a little special kind of communism when other places were more subservient to Moscow. Can you just very briefly explain how Hungary was different than the neighboring states in the Warsaw Pact?
Yes. Hungary was always a pain in the ass for Moscow because the Hungarians felt themselves drawn to the west, not to the east, and because Hungary is also one of the great, like the Ukraine, one of the great bread baskets of Europe. It is an enormously productive agricultural country.
And it was a spirited place because I remember in the 1980s, before the wall fell, being on a train with friends from Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia at the time, going to Budapest because they wanted to go to McDonald's. And it was the first McDonald's in the communist world. And ironically, they stood in line for an hour to get American fast food.
Of course, because it was something new and it was something from the West.
But Hungary was the place you'd go to get a magazine you couldn't get in Prague or you couldn't get in Warsaw.
Now, when
we go to Hungary today, when we go to Budapest, there's a couple of sites that I just think are so powerful. There's the House of Terror and there's the Memento Park. Can you tell us a little bit about, because as I mentioned in the introduction, Hungary went from under the Nazis to under the communists, and they had the secret police in both of those reigns of terror. And today, in what was the clubhouse for this sort of hellish society, you flipped from the headquarters of the secret police under Nazis to the headquarters for the secret police under the communists. And today, it memorializes that in a very powerful way.
Oh, yes, the House of Terror is amazing and absolutely something that anybody traveling to Hungary should visit, because to my knowledge, there isn't an equivalent. You can go to Moscow, but there's no museum in Moscow that attempts to show you what life was like in the Soviet Union from 1919 to the death of Stalin. And the same is true for the rest of Eastern Europe, but that museum in Budapest is extraordinary and explains both the Hungarian Revolution and much about the failure of communism.
And a powerful takeaway for me, Michael, was at the end of the museum, they have something called the Wall of the Victimizers. And these were the brutal communist police and the people who were participating in this terrible reality for the people of Hungary that survived the fall of communism. And their victims were dead. They survived. They were never brought to justice. And they lived just down the street from the loved ones of the people they killed to this very day.
But this is also very true, with all due respect, of Eastern Europe. I mean, the amazing way in which the Germans have placed memorial stones to Jewish families that vanished during the Nazi years is another example of that. I think Europeans are, on the whole, much more conscious of the horrors that the world went through than are we in England or in the United States as well. They remember what we don't.
And it was drilled into them with propaganda and oppressive statues everywhere they looked. You had that
everywhere.
The Liberation Monument on the hill overlooking Budapest, which just was a reminder of their Moscow overlords. And today, one of the most popular sites in Budapest is the Memento Park, or what a lot of people call Statue Park. Did you go out there and see all these statues?
Yeah, it is. It is extraordinary.
So they didn't melt down the statues. They just collected them in a park outside of town. And now, you know, grandparents can take their kids out there and tell them what it was like in the 1950s.
Yes. Well, some of them are pretty broken up. But yeah, the ones that were saved are now there. But that's something you won't find in Russia. The Russians suffer, actually, I think, from an inability to look back at their past in terms of museums and displays. But the Hungarians have done a wonderful job of making it clear just what that past was like. And I think it's one of the many things that makes Budapest a place worth visiting.
You know, that's interesting because in our country now we have a controversy about what do you do with statues of Confederate soldiers? Well, what Hungary did with all the propaganda statues that lionized the people that kept them down was take them out to a park and make a learning experience out of it. You've still got them there, and everybody can go out and remember what their heritage was. And if they want to make a teaching moment out of that for their kids, they can do that.
I think that that's a wonderful thing to do, actually, and a wonderful idea for what we should have done and ought to be doing here in this country as well.
Michael Korda, it's so great to talk to you. Your book, Journey to a Revolution, a personal memoir and history of Hungarian Revolution in 1956, is a treasure for anybody that wants to better understand the struggle of the people of Central or Eastern Europe when it came to earning and winning their freedom. And when I think about Hungary, it's just such a poignant mix. And I go to Heroes Square, which I think was built in 1896, the 100th birthday of the founding of Hungary, and it celebrates the very first people that came 1,000 years ago to Hungary, reminding locals of the hard-fought history that they have today. When you go to Heroes Square, and when you think of 1,000 years of struggle and the resilience of the Hungarian people, and then when you think of the struggles they had, which you participated in the communist times, 50 years ruled by Moscow, and then you think of the struggles in Hungary today, Hungarian democracy under Viktor Orban, if you want to still call it democracy, how do you bring all that together? What can a takeaway be right now when we think of the challenges that face the Hungarian people and their resilience and their heritage?
Well, I think they've always kept to their heritage. The present government of Hungary is one which we deplore, but at its worst, it's hundreds of times better than what existed under the communist government of Hungary until the fall of the Soviet Union. So I think you have to regard the present political position in Hungary as a way station on the way to something else, not a permanent condition.
I think that's a very hopeful thought.
I hope it is, and I feel that way, certainly.
Because one thing we can learn from history is you just cannot wish freedom away from a proud people like the Hungarians. That will be an ember at a minimum and an inspirational flame when it's left free to thrive. Michael Korda, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes in your teaching and your travels.
Many thanks. Many thanks for having me.
Michael Korda's latest work is Muse of Fire, World War I, as seen through the lives of soldier poets. I recently wrote about my favorite places, people, and stories from a lifetime of exploring Europe in my own book called For the Love of Europe. Here's what I observed after visiting a difficult historical site near Munich. Dachau, forgive but never forget. En route to Dachau's infamous concentration camp, I sit next to an old German woman on the city bus. I smile at her weakly as if to say, I don't hold your people's genocidal atrocities against you. She glances at me and sneers down at my camera. Suddenly, surprising me with her crusty but fluent English, she rips into me. She says, you tourists come here not to learn, but to hate. Pulling the loose skin down from a long-ago strong upper arm, she shows me a two-sided scar. She says, when I was a girl, a bullet cut straight through my arm. Another bullet killed my father. The war took many good people. My father ran a Gruscott shop. I'm stunned by her rage, but I sense a desperation on her part to simply unload her story on one of the hordes of tourists who tramp daily through her town, tramping through to gawk at an icon of the Holocaust. I ask, what do you mean, a Gruscott shop? She explains that in Bavaria, shopkeepers greet customers with a cheery Gruscott, or praise God. During the Third Reich, it was safer to change the greeting to Sieg Heil. It was a hard choice. Each shopkeeper had to make it. As more and more shops became Sieg Heil shops, everyone in Dachau knew which shops remained Gruscott shops. Pausing, as if mustering the energy for one last sentence, she stands up and says, my father's shop was the last Gruscott shop. Then she steps off the bus. By the end of the line, there were only tourists and pilgrims on the bus. Together, in silence, we walk into the concentration camp. Dachau, founded in 1933, was the first concentration camp, a model camp, and a training ground for wannabe camp commandants who studied such subjects as crowd control and torture. The camp at Dachau was built to hold 5,000, but on Liberation Day in 1945, 30,000 were packed inside its walls. Some 3,000 were so sick that they died after liberation. The number of Dachau deaths is estimated at 40,000, but the total will never be known. Thousands of Russian soldiers were brought here as prisoners. Not even registered, they were simply taken into the field and shot. Dachau is both a barbed wire box of memories and an eternal flame for the future. The sound of hushed voices and sad feet on the pebbled walk seems to promise remembrance, while the breeze whispers never again through trees that stand on the parade ground where inmates once stood. A statue, as big as the train cars that brought in the inmates, marks the middle of the camp. It's a black steel tangle of bodies, like the real ones found woven together at the gas chamber door. At its base, in French, English, German, Russian, and Hebrew, is the wish of the survivors. Forgive, but never forget.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio.